For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, find out why some young bull riders in the Tucson Rodeo have chosen a sport that promises so many rough rides. Meet Jody Falwell, a clay artist who blends tradition with politics as a pioneer of contemporary Native American pottery. And I'll talk with author John Peterson about the 40th anniversary of a game changer, the first role-playing game, Dungeons and Dragons. Those stories are all featured next on Arizona Spotlight. La Fiesta de los Vaqueros enters the final rounds of competition at the Tucson Rodeo Grounds this weekend. More than 650 cowboys and cowgirls are competing with $500,000 in prize money and serious bragging rights at stake. Among the favorites for fans is bull riding, a chance to witness a competitor trying to hang on for the toughest 8 seconds of his life. Northwest of Tucson, in Marana, young bull riders learn and practice their craft. They show up full of adrenaline on Friday nights to test their will and their skill. It can be a rough ride, but they all have their reasons for coming back, as Mitchell Riley found out.
Imagine 1,800 pounds against 160 pounds. So, it's about what it feels like.
24-year-old Weston Wright is getting ready for his first ride of the night. He's rosining the rope that he'll wrap around the chest of a rodeo bull by the name of Nubs.
Gives you a little extra grip. I've got Nubs for 2 draws, first and second turnout. I'll be on him twice tonight. My dad got me into it. He was a bull rider. Grandfather was a bull rider. Just kind of in the family.
Wright is a lanky cowboy with a tattoo over his left eye that reads established 1989. He says he had to change the way he rides bulls due to a series of injuries.
Yeah, I can't ride left-handed anymore. So I've trained myself to ride right-handed.
Nubs is in the chute as Wright takes his position on the bull's back. Several other cowboys help him as he adjusts his grip and the rope is tightened. Two rodeo clowns, also known as bullfighters, are in the ring at the ready. The gate opens.
It hurt.
Wright didn't get his 8 seconds, but he says staying on a bull that wants you off his back can be a guessing game.
You never have it figured out. They'll pretend to go left, you set up to go left with them, and they'll blow to the right. The whole key is just stay center, stay with them, stay on top of their shoulders.
Under the lights, you can see dust in the air from I-10. The dirt parking lot is full of pickup trucks, and cowboys stand near the pens, sharing stories about their last ride.
Came back onto him, you were on top of his neck.
There are young and old in the grandstand, mostly friends and family, there to support the riders. Over the past 4 or 5 years, young bull riders have gathered here at Western Heritage Arena to practice.
If you get bucked off and you know you had them, just take what you did right there and move it on to the next bull and keep on trying and trying.
That's 11-year-old Sawyer Sibley. He says it's the kinship with fellow riders that he appreciates most.
You know, I have my friend right here. He keeps it going with me. He always has me going on stuff. I got booked off. He'll keep me going, so he's like family to me.
Tonight, Sawyer will ride a steer named Hot Chocolate. He says he does get scared, but turns that feeling to his favor.
Use that fear against you. Use that fear for power. Because if that bull's making you scared, use that fear and use it against him.
It's cool to see a lot of young, talented young kids coming out here, getting off the streets and trying to succeed at something that they feel is a good sport in their eyes. And I just kind of tell the story how it is.
He does tell the story. John Schmidt is the master of ceremonies and ring announcer. For 15 years, he was a rodeo bull rider and also rode bareback.
You know, I don't rodeo anymore, and I help mama with the cattle, being able to feed, and as you can see, everybody else out here does all the work.
Mama is Aaliyah Jones, owner of Lightning Bulls and provider of all the rodeo stock at the arena on Friday nights. With names like Cowtown, 21 Guns, and Desert Storm, they range in size and rank.
Let them try to the best of their ability. You can't walk before you crawl, so there's all calibers of bulls so they can learn from.
From peewee bulls on up to jackpot bulls, it's $20 a ride. $50 will put your name in the jackpot. A rider can win as much as $500 from collected entry fees if they're able to stay on for 8 seconds. And both rider and bull are judged to be the best. The riders come from places like Queen Creek, Sonoyta, Wilcox, and Benson to learn from each other and practice on these bulls. 24-year-old Clint Holcomb is one local rider who's won a couple of jackpots in this arena and is proving himself on the rodeo circuit.
I rode Grand Canyon Pro Rodeo Association last year. I won the bull riding championship in that. And then this year, I'm doing Grand Canyon Pro Rodeo again, and I'm also doing PRCA.
Holcomb works for the Pima County Fairgrounds during the week and rodeos on weekends.
Hopefully at some point, it'll just be rodeo.
He says the key to getting better is not giving up and not giving in.
You just gotta keep going at it, keep practicing, and not quit when you get hurt.
And like most rodeo cowboys, he's been hurt a time or two, but he keeps coming back, trying to get better.
Stay in it! Broke my neck, broke my arm, detached ligaments in my ankle and my wrist, tore my MCL a couple times. You're either gonna love it or hate it, and if you love it, you wanna keep doing it. It's one of those things that even if it hurts, you're gonna wanna keep doing it.
Tonight, Holcomb will ride a little blue bull named Widget. John Schmidt says Widget has the biggest heart of all the bulls in the bunch. The gate opens. Clint Holcomb had a good ride, about 6 seconds. Not enough to earn a score.
They didn't quite make the eight, so yeah. Close is good, but not quite a paycheck.
He knows exactly what happened during that 6 second ride.
He got my hips shifted out real bad when he turned back, and I had to fight real hard to get him back in the center, but I overdid it a little bit and put him to the inside too much, and that's what did me in. I'm good to go again.
That reflection on his last ride is what these Friday night bull riding sessions are all about. Learning, getting better, and going again. What's your name?
Dustin Gonzalez. I am 18. Been riding since I was 13, so I don't plan on stopping now.
Which bull were you on?
21 Guns. He's a very fast bull.
How'd you do?
I got stepped on and hooked a little bit, but it comes with the game. We all have our good days and bad days.
What's the key to being a good bull rider, you think?
Just have a lot of try and heart with it. Try is the key, and having heart comes with try. I just love it because there ain't nothing better than sitting down on the back of a bull and giving it all you got out there, knowing that you can either die tonight or you can ride again.
Hey, you know how to ride. Get it done now, son.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Mitchell Riley.
Jody Falwell is an internationally known clay artist from Santa Clara Pueblo, New Mexico. She's visiting Tucson this weekend as the featured artist in the Arizona State Museum's Southwest Indian Art Festival. Falwell is known as the matriarch of Native American avant-garde pottery because she often adds contemporary images to traditional designs, and she doesn't shy away from making political statements. Luis Carrion met with her for this story.
The first thing that becomes apparent when one sees Jody Falwell working with clay is how at ease she is manipulating the medium. She grabs and kneads large chunks of earthen-colored clay nonchalantly as she begins the assembly of one of her famous pots, all while chatting comfortably in the backyard of her daughter's Tucson home.
I come from a pottery family. My great-grandmother made pottery. My mother made pottery.
Falwell says coming from a pottery family means she was born into the world of art without realizing it. The clay becomes part of daily life, and the rituals of making art become part of who she is.
It's a real interesting way of living because you think that that's normal. Everybody that comes from a pottery family go through the whole process, and along the way you say, you know, I don't think I'm going to ever do this because this is too difficult for me to have to deal with because this is what I grew up with, and there has to be something different. But as I found in life, that was exactly what I was meant to do more than anything else.
Falwell, who's now in her 70s, says working with clay has provided a path for self-discovery.
For me, I really like the idea of a great deal of calmness in my life. Sometimes all it requires is just calmness and quietness in your life to be able to allow your work to continue. Sometimes when there's so much activity around you, it's difficult for you to be able to work.
Falwell is considered a pioneer in avant-garde Native American pottery, and her work often features asymmetrical designs, innovative colors, and political commentary. It's a direction she says she took soon after graduate school.
When I first started making pottery, no one, I mean no one, would purchase my pottery. I couldn't even give my pottery away. Nobody wanted it. So I started thinking about how can I change this? And all of a sudden it occurred to me, all you need to do is take that extra tiny little step sideways from the norm of traditional pottery, and there might be success in that.
What you are looking at is a Santa Clara Pueblo pottery piece by Jody Falwell.
That's Andrew Higgins, assistant curator of ethnological collections at the Arizona State Museum at the University of Arizona. He's in the museum's climate-controlled pottery vault,
where we have over 20,000 ceramics. 16,000 are approximately prehistoric ceramics, and the rest, 4,000 to 5,000, are historic and contemporary. And we're still actively buying contemporary pottery today.
Higgins says Santa Clara pottery has certain distinctive characteristics that differentiate it from that of other groups.
Earlier, it began with lots of blackware, and then here you can see incising or carving. And this artist has carved an Avanyu or plume serpent, which is a motif, not just a motif, but a part of the Pueblo religion, and it's gone on for many, many years. And Jody Falwell still incorporates this into her designs because it has a deep meaning to her and the culture.
Higgins says the museum's collection shows how Santa Clara pottery evolved into polychromatic designs that incorporate natural pigments. Higgins then points to a piece by Jody Falwell.
And of course, when you look at that, you don't think Santa Clara Pueblo pottery because it has salmon on it. But if you know Jody Falwell, it would fit in well because she is really the matriarch of really getting Pueblo pottery into a whole new world of she does so many different elements of different forms, political commentary, social commentary, and she has just, she really just turned the corner for Pueblo pottery and inspired a lot of artists, and she still inspires today of what they can do because there's no can't in what she does. She makes you really think, and that is just so amazing that she's such an artist that can do that.
She was very well known for social and political commentary.
That's Susan Falwell, Jody Falwell's daughter, who lives in Tucson.
Isn't this nice clay?
She says the legacy of the pottery family was passed on to her, and she works as an artist, sometimes collaborating with her mom.
We dig the clay from the reservation, and I still get it from the reservation myself, even though I live in Tucson. All the traditional potters, contemporary potters from the Pueblo that you come from, we all get it from the same place. So you're always in tune with where you come from. So even though I'm in Tucson, or people are still on the reservation today, or there's potters that have moved out to California, there's always, as long as you're using clay from the reservation, it feels like it's a form of home. It's the core of kind of who you are.
Susan says she's been inspired by the innovative direction that her mother took in her work early in her career. And she sees an artistic evolution that continues today.
And I find that interesting because she made a career and opened up many doors for the next generation of potters from her avant-garde imagery and ideas and things she wanted the world to know about. But she's come full circle and has come back to just pure form, which I think is fantastic. It's really elegant and lovely.
It's extremely exciting to be able to take this whole concept of changing traditional art just even slightly.
The elder Falwell says her evolution as an artist has been intuitive. It's something she's had to do to find her voice and be true to herself.
I find it very pleasurable to know that I made even the slightest change in this world. And it's so minute, but it's there. And where it goes from there depends totally on the younger people and the younger potters who are going to make those changes.
Jody Falwell is the featured artist at the Southwest Indian Art Fair this Saturday and Sunday, just inside the main gate of the University of Arizona. Get more information at azpm.org. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Luis Carrion.
Jody Falwell and more than 200 other artists will participate in the Southwest Indian Art Festival this Saturday and Sunday at the Arizona State Museum near the U of A main gate. You can also see Jody Falwell at work on our website, news.azpm.org. If you mention Dungeons and Dragons to most people, you'll find it either inspires a big grin of nostalgia or a blank stare. What seems like a nerdy pastime full of math and maps and dice to some is to others the key to a unique fantasy experience that's unlike books, films, or video games. Many of Dungeons & Dragons' current players weren't even born in 1974 when the idea of role-playing games first emerged. My guest, John Peterson, documented the story behind D&D's success in his book Playing at the World, a history of simulating wars, people, and fantastic adventures from chess to role-playing games.
I got started on this basically because I felt that there was a story to be told about the place that these games had taken in our culture, especially as today we see video games commanding sales figures that are the envy of major Hollywood studios. To be able to trace back the origins of the technologies, of the settings, of the ideas that have created this new, vibrant, and actually quite significant aspect of American culture. I didn't think anybody had really taken that on previously, and that's what I took on.
Let's talk about the specific instances that came together to make Dungeons & Dragons such a game changer when it came out in the early 1970s.
First of all, you have to appreciate that this was a time when Tolkien had just really was at the crest of monumental popularity as an author. Tolkien's works had become available in inexpensive paperback editions for the first time in the mid-1960s. And once it became clear just how successful those were going to be, publishers brought all sorts of new fantasy fiction, new swords and sorcery things. The old Conan yarns, which had originally been published in the 1930s, were brought back into print then as well. And so one of the things that Dungeons & Dragons did was it took a category of gaming that had been kind of a niche sort of game. This was called war gaming. This is mostly historical simulations that were played out on boards that let you refight the Battle of Gettysburg, say, or the Battle of D-Day. It took the principles of simulating conflict from those war games and tried to apply them to the fantasy world. And in so doing, it also combined into this an idea of character, an idea that each player was going to have kind of a surrogate in the game. And this was a very transformative breakthrough. They made this something about you and the personal progression of your character in the game.
Who were the earliest players of Dungeons & Dragons?
So the two fellows who created Dungeons & Dragons were Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson. And Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson both came out of this wargaming community. They had both been hobbyists since the mid-1960s.
And what part of the country are we talking about?
They're both Midwesterners. So Dave Arneson grew up in St. Paul in the Twin Cities. Gary Gygax was based in the town of Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which is a resort town about 2 hours north of Chicago that at the time was really just famous as being a place for well-heeled folks from Chicago to go in the summer in their nice summer homes kind of along the lake. But today, I think actually Lake Geneva, Wisconsin is famous mostly for being the birthplace of Dungeons & Dragons. Gary and Dave met at a convention called Gen Con. This is actually a very famous wargaming convention that Gary Gygax founded in 1968. It was called the Lake Geneva War Games Convention, or the Geneva Convention for short, or for even shorter, it became Gen Con. Gen Con still goes on today, though now we do it in Indianapolis, not in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. They first met there in 1969, and at that time, they were both already working on wargaming rules. The first set of wargaming rules they were interested in working on together was actually a set of naval rules for the Napoleonic era. So a pretty niche dimension of this. But in 1971, Gary published a medieval fantasy war game called Chainmail. Chainmail popped a lot of monocles from the eyes of people in the wargaming community who had really taken wargames as something very serious. We're doing historical simulation, and what's this of bringing in dragons and orcs and ents and balrogs and all that and making that a part of wargames? People said it was childish, it was very controversial, but among younger wargamers, it was extremely compelling. And Dave Arneson was one of the first to kind of connect up with Chainmail and begin to adapt and expand it, and it was in his play in the Twin Cities that he came up with the idea that maybe rather than just having these forces be fighting out in the middle of a battlefield with a massive army, instead you could have small tactical groups that were exploring an underground space like a dungeon and would fight monsters there and get their loot and come back out. And it was when Dave showed that prototype to Gary that they, this was late in 1972, that they began collaborating on the Dungeons & Dragons rules.
So what would you say were the key events, though, that turned this from a niche part of the gaming community into a really big business?
There's a certain irony in the story of how D&D went from being something that a few hobbyists, these people in the wargaming community or fans of fantasy fiction, played largely in college campuses, to how this became a mainstream phenomenon. It's actually a famous story, but a story that is widely misunderstood. And it's the story of a kid named James Dallas Egbert. James Dallas Egbert disappeared from a university in Michigan in the summer of 1979. And his parents hired a private investigator to try to find out what had happened to their son. So that this guy came to the James Dallas Egbert's dorm room, went through his possessions, and found copies of Dungeons & Dragons. And he'd never heard of it before, because virtually no one had outside of these very insular communities that were interested in these games. And so he started asking questions about the university, about how people played D&D. And he got a variety of information, some of which seems plausible, some of which seems rather suspect, to my ears anyway. But he became fixated on the notion that James Dallas Egbert had begun to play a live-action version of D&D in the steam tunnels beneath the university, because he had, apparently the game had warped his mind, and he believed it was real. And he was down in these steam tunnels, and he may be injured or just terribly confused, and that he absolutely needed to be found. For various reasons, though, the university was reluctant to let Deere search the steam tunnels, and because of that, Deere, the private investigator, he went to the media, and just day after day, you know, propounded this theory that James Dallas Egbert had gone insane because of this game, Dungeons & Dragons, and was lost under the steam tunnels at the university. And this became front page news on the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. This was, you know, on nightly television broadcasts. And this was the first place most people in the world heard of D&D. It was this cult game. Cult was used a lot in the headlines for this, that would make you lose touch with reality. Now, it turned out this was entirely fatuous, based on a completely misguided hunch. In fact, this kid had run away, was in Louisiana. A couple weeks later, he turned himself in, and the reasons for his disappearance had nothing to do with D&D whatsoever. But, you know, the media being what it is, that wasn't the story that ended up in the headlines, right? The retractions didn't really get the same attention that some of these earlier and more sensational claims had gotten. But as a consequence of this, this very nerdy, niche game got something it couldn't have gotten any other way, this kind of dangerous reputation, this like rebellious cachet. And this caused more teenagers to buy D&D than anything else could, any amount of marketing money that TSR, the company that published D&D, could have mustered on their own. And so although it was based on this phenomenal misunderstanding, that's certainly what got it into the public eye and began the D&D fad, when you would see D&D going from making, as it did in, say, 1978 to 79, $1 million a year, to by 1983 to 84, $30 million a year.
Paint a little picture for us of how omnipresent Dungeons & Dragons was at the height of its success.
There really was a fad for Dungeons & Dragons, again, that lasted, I'd say, from 79, from the time that it was front page news in the New York Times, you know, up to really the release of Trivial Pursuit. If you look at what ended up displacing Dungeons & Dragons from the display stands at the front of Walden Books and B. Dalton, companies that, of course, are no longer with us, you know, it was games like Trivial Pursuit that kind of took it the place of it as a fad.
But what about computers coming in and the idea that you could suddenly play a game without having to do so much math?
There's no doubt that D&D requires a lot of number crunching, and it's actually very difficult to adjudicate combat fairly by D&D rules. And in fact, as you get into higher level characters, more powerful monsters, it's effectively impossible for humans to execute the system fairly. You always make some kinds of mistakes when you try to do D&D. And so certainly computer games provided a convenience that role-playing games really lacked. I mean, both in the sense that they did the system for you, but they also provided a substitute for a gaming group for those times when it wasn't convenient for you to get one. And, you know, this is in some respects one of the real hurdles to doing tabletop role-playing, is you've got to find some like-minded people who are going to sit around a table with you and commit to do this regularly, and they're going to have to be people who are interested in the same kinds of stories that you are. But, of course, the flip side of that is that that's also what makes tabletop gaming so vital even today, is that it's really an opportunity for you and a small group of other people to invent and to believe in an adventure that's entirely, you know, of your own creation. And it only has to please those five people that are sitting around that table. Nobody else has to think it's a good idea. And that artisanal component to it, tabletop role-playing provides a real counterbalance to that that keeps it something that people want to do.
That was John Peterson. His book is Playing at the World, a history of simulating wars, people, and fantastic adventures from chess to role-playing games. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM radio studios. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.